Welcome to 2024 and Season 5 of the Religion Podcast, where a rabbi and a reverend walk into a podcast and talk real about religion.
Hello, Reverend Joel.
Howdy, Rabbi Eric. How y'all?
I know there's some bugs on my floor, but we're okay. We're okay. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I had a week off after Easter. Traveled to North Carolina to move my youngest back into the home with us.
And you know it's close to North Carolina, right?
It's not as close as you think. I didn't get to Charlotte. I only got to Winston-Salem. So I was still
I was thinking Athens, but...
Yes. Right. I was still 5 or 6 hours from you.
All right.
Exactly.
You were missed yesterday. I was thinking about you. The interfaith partnership that you used to be a big part of... I guess they were starved for programs, so they asked me to come and talk about Passover.
Oh, wow.
it was really fun. I was really thankful for the opportunity, and I did, you know, I had a little kind of presentation. It was neat.
I still remember when we had, like, I don't know, a Sunday service, and I had you come talk about Passover in worship with us. That was so awesome. I'm so grateful.
I remember that. And the audio was messed up, so it wasn't recorded that day because my congregants wanted to hear it.
Yeah, of course. When you have volunteers working
this. I've let it go, though, Joel. I've let it go.
I haven't. I'm still I'm always pissed when our video and audio don't work right.
I know.
There's no excuse, right? I need a pro.
And it works it works every time except for the times when you really want it to work. that's some sort of Murphy's theological law or church law or something, temple. Anyway. What do we got today, my man?
Well, I've got we've got a listener email. It obviously comes from a Christian worldview, so it's mostly what do Jews believe. This is a person who's been listening to us for the whole time, for over 3 years or so, and as a Christian, it can get hard to sit with other religions and wonder, okay. What now? Because Christians are so belief-centered sometimes. So I just want to read you some of this person's questions, and we'll break them out through the rest of the episode. For example, do Jews believe or expect a Messiah? And if so, what qualities will that person have, and what is the purpose of a Messiah? Let's start there. how does that one strike you?
Man, I've like barely had a few sips of coffee. You're talking about eschatology now, and man. Yeah, so big preface that you know, hopefully is maybe not obvious, but you know, I could give a general answer, but the joke that we've talked about many times is when there's two Jews, there's three opinions. So you know, I could give you a little bit of perspective, but remember that I'm coming from a Reform background. You know, I can give a perspective on kind of a normative or, you know, traditional approach to things. But, and I'll try to be clear when I speak for what I believe versus for, you know, when I speak for what I think, you know, normative Judaism, for lack of a better expression, believes. But all that aside, and you can edit that out if you want. That might be
no. That's perfect. Christians are totally accustomed to that in all of our denominations and ways of being. Catholic versus Lutheran versus Baptist versus non-denominational. We get that whenever we speak, we are not speaking only for the global. We are speaking for the personal.
So I'll say that I'll start with something that all Jews agree on. And I do not mean this polemically. This is not meant as like a fight that we need to win, but it is a major difference between Christianity and Judaism, and a difference that makes each of our religions unique is that Judaism does not believe that a Messiah has already come. No Jew believes that a Messiah has come. And no Jew believes that Jesus was the Son of God. Now, I need to caveat that a little bit because there is a thing called Jews for Jesus or Messianic Judaism. You and I have talked about that before. We both get a little bit, you know, I don't want to be insulting, but yeah, Joel just made like a icky face. Like it's a little weird. You know, sometimes Jews say, well, they're not Jews, they're Christian. And you and I have talked about this before. Like Christians don't want them either, right? Like they're not really. And, you know, adding to this is the fact, and again, I'm not trying to be snarky or insult anyone, but my experience is that many people who call themselves Jews for Jesus, I don't know how else to say it, are a little bit culty. There was just an incident in Athens at a commissioner's meeting where someone calling himself a rabbi basically he got tased is the short answer. I could send you the article, Joel. I don't know. And I'm friends with our mayor, as you know, I think you know him too, Joel, Mayor Gertz. And I emailed the commission. I said, I just want everyone, you know, I basically said in more professional language, this person is not who we are. You know, like, I just want to be very clear. They may call themselves Jewish. And it's possible this person was born to a Jewish mother. And of course that gets to the conversation we've had in the past of like, you know, what does it really mean to call yourself Jewish and have identity? But all of that aside, to actually answer your question, and apologies for the segue, is the Messiah has not come yet in Judaism. So, part of the question was, you know, what qualifies as the Messiah? Let me back up again. Many Jews, myself included, don't necessarily even believe in the coming of a Messiah, as in an actual person or being that, you know, the way I express it is like, you know, snap of the fingers, Messiah comes, the world is better, or the world ends, or the temple is rebuilt, any of those things. I personally do not believe that. But there are Jews that do, and it is part of traditional Judaism. The Messiah will be descended from King David, again, according to, you know, traditional Judaism. And one of the things that the Messiah will do is rebuild the temple. We call it building the third temple. So the first temple was destroyed in 586 CE. The second temple, a date that I tell all people interested in religion, a date that everyone should know because it was the, maybe not the, but certainly a huge watershed, liminal space, I'm using all my words today, for Judaism when the temple was destroyed in the year 70.
And we basically,
yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's where the diaspora started, et cetera, et cetera. Lots to say about that. So we don't do sacrifices anymore because the temple was destroyed. It's actually not because, oh, our ethics and we love animals. I mean, that's what I would say. That's what I just want to be clear. I don't want to do sacrifices. I think it's icky. I get a little prick of blood on my finger. I get all fainty. But the reason from Jewish law that we don't do sacrifices is because we don't have the temple. So one of the things the Messiah will do is build the third temple and we'll go back to the sacrificial system. Some believe that the Messiah will resurrect the dead or that God will resurrect the dead in conjunction with the Messiah. I mean, there's varying theological and eschatological beliefs. You know, is it in history? Is it outside of history? But I think that the basic important thing to hold on to with regard to Judaism is that the Messiah has not come. We, by doing mitzvot, by doing Jewish law, again, according to traditional Judaism, can hasten the coming of the Messiah. So there's this idea that we can actually help bring about the Messiah. And to end on kind of a practical note, something that I absolutely believe is that by living a life of Torah and Judaism, and that's Torah with a capital T, of course, we bring about what I'll call a messianic age, a better future. We talked about Tikkun Olam either last episode or two episodes ago, healing the world. That's my equivalent to a Messiah. But I do want to be clear that there are lots of Jews that absolutely do believe in an actual Messiah. But again, not Jesus, hasn't come yet. We're waiting, you know, or, you know, those Jews are waiting for him to come. And, you know, it will be a he, according to the tradition. So that's my very short answer that you can edit as you see fit.
Let's pin down a few little corners if we can. So the purpose of the Messiah is to, one, rebuild the third temple, oversee the rebuilding of the third temple, and launch this new age. It's not a snap fingers moment, the temple or the age, but the presence of the new Messiah begins both the third and final and eternal temple, as well as the great age of relationship with God, with self, with others, with neighbors, with enemies, where all things are better and different, and as God intended them to be, and the commandments are fulfilled in some new, beautiful way. That's kind of how we would recognize the qualities and the purpose of the Messiah. Am I getting close?
Yes. You know, I think even within Jewish frameworks that have a belief in a Messiah, that all is different depending on strand of Judaism, personal belief, etc.
Sure.
But building the third temple is pretty common.
Okay.
In Gathering of the Exiles, I didn't mention that as another one, which is basically that... And again, this is kind of in tension with a lot of my belief, certainly, and I would think my congregation is, you know, we'll all move to Israel, right? Mm. And I, you know, Israel's a loaded term right now. I don't want to get into that, but there's also the idea that there'll be, you know, the Messiah will bring about shalom in the entirety of the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all sorts of things that are kind of lopped on to the Messiah. But I think the one that is the most common is the building or rebuilding of the temple.
And the reason for the temple isn't itself. It's also the center of human community. And it's the gathering point from north, south, east, west of the in gathering is the way you said it. But it's how to know where to go. And it's how to know how to live. So here's another side question that was asked in the email that might be a little tangential, but also might bring some clarity. So is whatever this Messiah or whoever this Messiah is, is he expected from government or military or a school or a synagogue, from wealth or from poverty? Is there any traits that will help you recognize?
So here's where, like, we have a wealth of beautiful midrashim. You know, there's this, and I think you'll appreciate this, Joel. There's this whole body of literature that suggests that the Messiah is a leper and poor. And there's this other thing that, like, throughout Jewish history, there's been people that have proclaimed themselves the Messiah, and there's this whole thing of, like, that's how you know someone's not, because the Messiah will be really humble, and, you know, there's all of these beautiful stories, and for me, the power of those stories is they remind me of morals that I should live by. You know, it's not so much about the Messiah, it's about kind of, you know, me and my life and my community's life. But yeah, if people want to go down that road, there's a lot there. I mean, a lot. Okay, I'll also say, and I think this is important, I think we've talked about it way in the past, like past seasons, the Torah, the five books of Moses, say nothing, absolutely zilch, about life after death, Messiah. You know, of course, the temple was after the Torah, so it wouldn't say anything about the temple. It's not until Talmudic times where this becomes a central idea.
And that makes perfect sense because the Torah, the first five books, were trying to get to the promised land, whatever that was. And then the rest of the Hebrew Bible is about trying to keep it or losing it or hoping to get it back, which is why you would need a Messiah. On your way to promised land, you don't need one to bring it back and to get us home again. But the rest of the prophets and the writings are memories and stories from where kings and leaders and temple personnel screwed up or did something beautifully or found the old writings and tore their clothes and committed themselves again or heard the old writings from a wise prophet and ignored them and picked a fight with an enemy. So those stories were written down, and it's what causes exile and diaspora versus what causes beautiful community. And so the dream of a Messiah is to stop that back and forthness of getting promised land, losing promised land, getting promised land, losing promised land.
I like that. And also, you know, it just the covenant changes with time in the sense of there very much is a transactional element to God giving us Israel. We have to behave in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the Torah kind of, as you said, like is very much about that.
So in all the wonderings about who and how this Messiah will be and what qualities this Messiah will have, there's a huge wealth of diversity in that. A question, though, will the Messiah come from inside or beyond the people of Israel? Is there anywhere in the Midrashim where it's imagined that this Messiah will not be from inside Israel?
I don't believe so.
Okay, that's helpful. And the law itself, the obedience to it, is it more reward or punishment? I don't know if that makes sense what I'm asking. Sometimes Christians use obedience or faith in order to achieve the reward of something that they believe comes later. And we also talk about obeying commandments as the reason why punishment / consequences land on us. How would you characterize law, a Torah, in respect to the Messiah's role of whatever lies ahead?
Sure. So let me give a very concrete example. So there are a sect of Jews, a sect of Hasidic Jews, that, you know, people talk about seeing them in New York, but it can be anywhere. New York has a lot of Jews. So where they'll go up to a person and ask, hey, are you Jewish? And if you answer yes, and you're male, because, you know, these mitzvot only apply if you're male, will ask you to wrap tefillin. Now, without going into a long thing, tefillin, fancy word, we call them the leather phylacteries. If you Google an image of tefillin, you'll get it. Yeah, Joel's making the sign. In the mornings, Jewish men, there's two pieces who observe this, wrap one piece around the wrist and one piece around the head. And it comes from, I'm almost positive it's Deuteronomy, where God says, you shall bind them as a sign before your eyes. And so we take that literally, and parts of that, the Shema, which includes those words, are on the arms and on the head. Okay. So the reason that these Jews are asking other people to do that, it's because they think that if they get more Jews to do more mitzvot, that will bring about the Messiah. Like there's almost like a magic number that, you know, we don't know, but God knows, that once that number of mitzvot is hit, the Messiah will come. There's also this idea. I mean, we have hundreds of things like this. There's this idea that if every Jew celebrated Shabbat just once, the way it's quote unquote supposed to be followed, the Messiah will come. So lots of things like this. So the answer to your question is a resounding yes. Mm-hmm.
It's a reward. Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. Got it.
Now there's also an idea that that some Jews have, that that it is completely in God's hands, and human action is absolutely separate from God's decision to bring the Messiah, which, if I were to believe in the Messiah, I find very depressing, right? Like that, like to me, covenantal theology means that what I do makes a difference. What you do, what we do. So makes a difference to God, okay? Of course it makes a difference, but you know what I mean. So, yeah.
And the way I've often said it in the Christian worldview is, of course, our faith and life and works and actions make a difference. They just can't make the difference. Like, we can't force God. We can't, because we did something, God goes, rats, they got me, and then has to do something. If God does something, it's out of covenantal love, not out of being trapped by human thought, will, obedience, disobedience, etc.
I like that, Joel. I like that.
All right. So you're helping me and maybe our listener as well. So the life after death, the way you've been describing it is, whatever the Messiah's role is, it is to bring a new presence, a new community, a new temple here amongst the people. And that's for those who are here. What about those who have died? Is there something for them? How are they thought of and remembered in Judaism?
So, well, those are two very different questions.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, because, I mean, how they're thought of and remembered makes me think of, like, mourning practices and also, like, how do people live on in our memories and things like that.
So, one is without a Messiah, and then two would be with a Messiah, right? How are they thought of and remembered until Messiah versus after?
Sure. So answering somewhat quickly, because this is a complex, your question is a very complex question, is there are, okay, so Maimonides, back in the day, formulated these attributes of God. And one of them is that God resurrects the dead, okay? Now, we have a prayer that we say three times a day. It's called the Amidah. I may have talked about it before. It translates to standing. Yeah, and yes, we stand during it. But it's also the most important prayer in Judaism. Some people will say it's the Shema, which declares God as one. Those people are wrong. And the Amidah, so this actually goes back to the temple stuff. When one says the Amidah in the context of a service, is meant to be precisely in the service where the sacrifice would have been in temple days. That's how important the Amidah is. And I could honestly speak for hours about the Amidah. It's a fascinating prayer. It changes depending on if it's Shabbat or if it's not Shabbat. There's all sorts of stuff. But the second blessing of the Amidah praises God's power, okay? And we praise God's power for providing rain and dew and all these things. And what else? What is the sine qua non of God's power? It is God resurrecting the dead. Because only, like, we as human beings are powerful and we imitate God, but God can resurrect the dead. Now, in my prayer book, in our prayer book, in Reformed Judaism, the words for resurrect the dead are in parentheses. And what most Reformed Jews say, what most Reformed Jews say instead of praised are you God who resurrects the dead are praised are you God who brings life to all or who renews all life, which is, of course, very different and much more generalized and perhaps less theologically problematic. But there is very much this idea that the coming of the Messiah will coincide with the resurrection of the dead. So much so, in fact, that there are some Jews that are buried with their feet facing Jerusalem so that when they're resurrected, they'll kind of get a head start. And I'll keep riffing.
I'm sorry to laugh at that.
No, I get it. I laugh at it. But it's also very, you know, it's beautiful too, right?
As if it's a race. If it's a race and you're trying to get there first, you've missed the point, homie.
It's the eschatological race. For a while, there was a real question about whether observant Jews could donate organs. Because if they donate organs and then they're resurrected, what does that mean? And this is the reason, you know, to make it a little somber, or apologies for making it somber. But there are a group of Israelis. I mean, this is in any Jewish community, but you'll see why I'm saying Israelis in a second. That when there is a tragic killing, like a bombing, and again, apologies, you know, trigger warning, this is going to be very visual. When there are bodies and body parts strewn about, they collect them. Mm-hmm. So that a person can be buried with as much of their physical selves as possible. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason for that, not all, but part of the reason for that is about the resurrection.
Sure. And there are Christians who will not be cremated, right? They don't believe in it, or will donate organs. They don't believe in it. If they do that, what would happen to them at the great resurrection or whatever? And then there are some Christians who do not believe in a great resurrection. They believe in a personal resurrection. And then there are others who don't believe in a bodily resurrection, just a spiritual resurrection. They abandon their body in some way, and just their spirit is renewed to that new life or something. And it's not about resurrecting the dead. It's about the eternal undying life of the spirit is how. So there's, Christians have a plethora of ways that we mangle resurrection theology as well. All right, last one. So Christians study and know and usually misunderstand, but try to respect the Hebrew Bible, which unfortunately we too often call the Old Testament, in addition to our Greek New Testament or the Greek Gospels and letters, which mostly had to do with the fall of the temple around 70. Almost all of the Gospels were written because of the threat to the temple or the fall of the temple. The letters preceded the Gospels, but the Gospels are what made it a book, a new book. The last question was, do Jews study Rabbi Jesus or the Greek Gospels and letters the way we study the Hebrew prophets and writings and Torah?
So the short answer is no. And it's not... It's not a like a defensive no in the sense of we don't study him. That's Christian. That's not.
Right.
But you know, so one reason I think is very practical in terms of there's so much to study and learn about what Jewish practice is today that studying what a Jew did in the first century may not seem as relevant. Note I said may not, not is not. Another thing is, you know, Jesus was a rabbi in the first century, as were many, many, many others. So here's where I think the question is a very specifically coming from a Christian background. Because for Christians, and I don't mean this like argumentatively or anything. For Christians, like, of course you'd study Jesus. He's like, you know, he's super important. For Jews, Jesus was a rabbi and a teacher in the first century, of which there were many. And, you know, we talk about Hillel and Shammai and Shmuel and Eliezer and all of these rabbis. You know, Jesus wasn't a part of the rabbinic tradition, as we call it, because he came before it. And he's not quoted in the Mishnah and Talmud. So, yes, he becomes important because of the writings of the Gospels, which were what, like 2nd, 3rd century? Is that?
The Gospels were 70, 80, 90, and 110
okay. So,
CE.
Got it. So late first and early second century.
Yeah.
So you know, asking why we don't study Jesus, it would be, it's almost like, to me, the question's almost similar, like, well, why don't we read the Quran? Like the Quran soup, you know? Although there is a difference.
And you probably Jesus do. Was, and, you
know, well, I don't, school. Only because there's no, I would love to. But, you know, I mean, that's a question of time. And also, you know, the Quran kind of needs a teacher. I would love to take a class on it or have someone, you know, read it with me and have discussions. I would love that. So, I don't know if that's
so Jesus was one rabbi before the rabbinic tradition, and whatever influence he had on the post-temple period that led to the Talmud and the rabbinical traditions getting more documented, he is one voice among many voices that tried to bend the people towards something, and later it became written down and remembered. But he's not a unique voice in that history, and he's pre rabbinical history in some way.
I think that's well said. He's pre rabbinical history. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Right. Now, the Maccabees are all around that same time, and their story is lifted up and remembered and honored carefully.
Yes.
And for us, the what we call first, second, third, fourth Maccabees are not a part of the Hebrew scriptures or the New Testament scriptures. They are in what we call the Apocrypha, a second class of semi-holy writings that may point us, but we don't consider them scripture. So we do study them, but we don't give them the same power as we give Ezekiel or Obadiah or something.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
You as well.
Is that helpful?
Very much so. And this makes me realize that what we need to do next week, because we're already at 30 minutes, but this is great. This, I think, is what the questioner needed. So a lot of this has sparked in me, like, ah, that makes so much sense. Because Saul of Tarsus, who became Paul, the author of seven of the letters in the New Testament, he was a Pharisaical Jew, which had certain beliefs. And in many of the Gospels, there are conversations between Rabbi Jesus and those who taught Pharisaical Judaism versus the Sadducee style versus the scribes of the temple. And you begin to see some of the push and pull between, let's call them, pre-sects of Judaism. They weren't even sects yet, right? They hadn't been codified as tightly as they would be later. But you begin to see the difference in what a Messiah is, the difference in what life versus life after death might mean, the reason why burial happened in certain ways, the reason why certain prophets were lifted up and others were diminished. Oh, it's beginning to make more sense to me as I chat with you about it today. And maybe what I want to get you to do is help ask me the questions that respond to what you presented today, so that the Christian worldview of the question itself is exposed. But then we can also
talk
about
I like that idea a lot.
Okay.
I mean, you know, part of the difference is, or part of the what would I call it? The challenge is that just the concept of Messiah is, I think, even for the Jews that do believe in a Messiah, so much more pronounced in Christianity than it is Judaism. I mean, so, you know, even so, in the prayers that Jews say three times a day, there's really only one part of the Amidah that kind of alludes to the Messiah. And even that is a metaphor. It's not actually, we want the Messiah now. Or at least that's my assumption. This is the kind of stuff I'll ask you about next time. I really do like that idea, Joel.
That's true. Yeah, let's give that a shot. Gee, thanks, Eric, for being so vulnerable and open and being a rabbi to us today, giving us lots to learn and appreciate. Thanks for your careful teaching and your God, all the effort that you've obviously put into this over your pre-professional and then professional lifetime. Because it's, I mean, I get it. You can't just do Judaism. You have to know it and do it in a way that your people don't, and therefore in a way that people who are beyond your people really don't. So thank you for the patience.
Oh, my pleasure. No, I mean, thank you and whoever wrote you for the questions. You know, sometimes we have to remind ourselves that not every, like, what's interesting to me about studying different religions is there's not always a corollary between my religion. So it's kind of asking, like, you know, well, so Moses is like Jesus, right? And Hanukkah is like Christmas, right? And Passover is like Easter, right? It's like, no. Like,
It's more like maybe, but don't start by imposing your worldview on my faith and practices. Ask a more open-ended question, please.
Right. And it's also, it helps expose the unique and beautiful particularities of our religions when we do that, as opposed to kind of putting it in an already predefined framework. Mm-hmm. But it's hard. It's hard to do that. But that's why I appreciate you and these conversations and this podcast and, you know, the whole thing.
Well, until next time, buddy, keep it real.
Keep it real. Shalom.
Thank you for joining us on the Real Religion Podcast today, where a rabbi and a reverend walk into a podcast and talk real about religion. I'm Reverend Joel Talbert, and on behalf of Rabbi Eric Linder and all the Real Religion fans out there, we thank you for being with us today and invite you to send us any feedback or suggestions or topic ideas to realreligionpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep it real.